Coming to you this morning across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at the ins and outs of rental home and vacation home financing. We're going to cover also B&B, Airbnb. So, Kerry, we're going to kind of break it down into three topics today. We're going to cover the types of financing that are available for vacation homes, or sometimes called second homes. We're going to cover financing available for rental property. And then there's really a new regulation, new thing in regard to property, and that's Airbnb.
Oh, yeah. We're starting to see a lot of that.
Yep. It's thrown a curve at all the lenders, and they're still trying to sort that out. So we're going to cover some of the ins and outs of that, too. I thought we might start today with rental home financing. And, Kerry, we have our own special terminology for rental homes. What are they called in the industry?
Non-owner occupied.
Or the
investment
acronym.
Property.
That's correct. But our acronym for non-owner occupied is NOO, which we probably didn't cover in our acronyms show.
No, probably.
But nevertheless, another abbreviation. That doesn't mean, no, you can't do this, but it does mean that we have to have special underwriting that is different for a non-owner occupied property than it is for a primary residence or a second home. So rental homes, as Kerry said, sometimes called investment properties. This is a home that a owner might hold for rental income purposes only. They will never use the house themselves for any personal use. So this applies to strictly rental property. There's a higher qualifying threshold for rental home financing. Why is that, Kerry?
Well, it's a bit of a higher risk product.
That's right. And all lending is done according to risk assessment. And a rental property is inherently a higher risk property because when it comes down to, do I make the payment on my rental property? Or do I make the payment on the home I'm living in? Which one do you think they're going to choose?
I know I'd make the payment on the home I'm
living in. That's right. And so what happens is there is financial stress on a borrower. They have to make realistic, real-world choices, and they will first pay their own home mortgage before they pay a rental home mortgage. So there's a higher default rate on rental property, and as a result, it's just rated as a higher-risk transaction. So the underwriting requirements are slightly more stringent to take care of that risk. How does a lender cover some of that risk, Kerry?
Well, a big part of it is just the pricing differences.
There's a rate differential. That's correct. So when you go to apply to purchase a rental property, you're not going to get the same rate as you're going to get with a owner-occupied property, with a home that you live in. It can vary from about three-quarters of a higher rate to about 1.25%, depending on the parameters of the loan. So other than interest rate to cover that higher risk, Kerry, what else does the lender use to ameliorate that risk?
There is a higher down payment required.
Correct. Whereas with a primary residence, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac will let you get into that home with as little as 5% down, and in some cases even 3% down. That is not going to happen with a rental property mortgage. The minimum down payment that is required is 15%, but that loan will also carry a very hefty PMI premium to help cover that risk. Most investment property loans are done with 20% down. If you want the absolute best rate that you can get, you'll want to put 25% down, and that's a pretty good chunk of change for most people. So investment property is not everyone's cup of tea, but on the other hand, it is an investment in a tangible asset that never loses its relative value, that if properly done, the rent can cover the mortgage payment, that within 15 to 20 years, if you have bought the house correctly, rented it correctly, you have a paid-for house that then becomes an income stream in retirement because you're collecting rent, you don't owe a mortgage payment anymore, or conversely, it can be a fairly liquid asset that you can sell at any time down the road. So rental homes are really an excellent investment. It's just it takes a little stronger profile to begin to be able to be a rental home owner. What other items, Carrie, are required to help in the risk abatement of these loans?
The minimum credit score is actually 680.
That's correct. And so on a primary residence with a conventional product, you could get in with a 620 score. The threshold for investment property is 680 or higher. I have had a few turndowns between 680 and 700, unless there were some pretty strong reserves and some other factors that offset it. But the threshold is a 680. And then investment property loans are not actually even available through FHA or VA or USDA. So it's only Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac channels that we can use, and their threshold is 680. What else in a borrower's profile would give the lender a little more comfort that this borrower is a little bit stronger than the average and may be able to be a rental home owner?
They require a good bit of reserves, and then reserves is the money left over after your funds that you bring to closing.
Right. So you don't physically have to bring your reserves to closing. It's just simply after you have liquidated all your closing funds, you must have a certain amount left over in the bank as reserves. And the reserves, and it makes sense. Maybe you have a stretch of months where the tenants vacated the property and you haven't re-rented it. You've got to be able to carry that mortgage payment.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you had savings in the bank to make that payment, that makes sense that you could carry it through a dry stretch. So how do they calculate reserves, Carrie? What figure do they use usually for calculating how much in reserves an investment property buyer might need?
You have to have 6 months of house payment, and that's principal, interest, and your taxes and insurance for all mortgages and all properties owned, including your primary residence.
Correct. So when we say, well, you need 2 months reserves, it's two times the house payments. If we say 6 months reserves, it's six times the house payments. But if you're buying an investment property, that is 6 months payments for all of the properties you own that have mortgages.
And is that including the property that you're purchasing as well?
It does include that one also, because you're adding that to your stable of homes. Correct. Now, many first-time investors will ask me this question. And they will say, well, look, I know the income that I have is not enough to cover the mortgage on this, but the rent is going to cover it way more. I'm going to get $1,200 rent for this property, and my mortgage payment's only $750. Why won't they lend me any money on this house? What's the problem with that, Carrie? Can we use the rent from the house that you are buying to offset the payment of the house that you're going to make?
Yes, but only if you've had previous landlord experience of 2 years.
That's right. And this is kind of, I liken this to trying to get your first job. You know, your first job, the question is always, well, where have you worked before and what have you done? And when the answer is, well, nowhere and nothing, it's hard to get that first job. Obtaining the first rental property is the most difficult because you do not have the landlord experience. And because you don't have the landlord experience, you cannot use the rent on that home that you're buying to offset the future payment that you'll be making. So once you have 2 years landlord history, and landlord history is verified through what method, Carrie? How do they know that you have landlord history?
You will have to have filed a Schedule E on your tax returns and listed that rental income there.
That's correct. That establishes you as a seasoned landlord with rental experience. And once you have that, the magic begins to happen, because then you can buy a house and use the future rent of the house you're buying. And how do you know what that is? Well, we have to do a rental appraisal. You can use that to offset the payment you'll be making. When we get back, we'll finish talking about rental home financing. Join us after the break.
Welcome back, everybody. This morning, we are talking about rental home and vacation home financing. As always, if you have questions on anything we're talking about, you can call us Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And you can catch all of our shows again on our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
And if none of those three work, you're out of luck.
Yeah, we're out of luck.
Call us anytime, folks. We're happy to entertain any questions or talk through any scenarios you may have. And I can often preempt a lot of potential issues by just covering the scenarios that you're interested in, the things you're looking at, the homes you're looking to buy. We can save you a lot of headaches and a lot of trouble down the road just by answering questions up front for you. So feel free to reach out to us. We're talking about non-owner-occupied properties. Those are investment properties or rental homes, and the financing that's required, and the thresholds that are a little bit higher for these homes because they represent a higher risk category as far as the property type goes. So we've talked about how you need a little higher credit score, a little more down payment. You're going to pay a little higher rate. You're going to have a little more reserves. All of these little things add up to a good bit of safety as far as the lender is concerned. But we find that the hardest loan to do is that first rental property you buy, because you cannot use the rent from that house to help you qualify. You have to be able to effectively, out of your own income, to make your current house payment plus the rental house payment with no benefit of any rent income coming in. However, once you've established yourself as a seasoned landlord, that is, you filed rental income on a Schedule E for 2 years, after that, the magic happens. You can begin to count, and you actually don't get to count 100% of the rent, but you get to count 75% of the fair market rent of the house that you're buying, and that can offset the payment of the house you're buying. And you're able then to begin to accumulate multiple rental properties. Now, there's an upper limit to the number of mortgages that you can hold and still obtain a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan. What's that number, Kerry?
10. You can have 10 financed properties.
And let's, just so we're clear on that, that's 10 financed properties. You may have already paid one or two off. You can own more than 10 properties, but they're going to actually count the mortgages, the number of mortgaged homes. And right now, Fannie Mae's limit is 10. Now, after the crash, we went just wacko on this, because before the crash, there was no limit. You could own 50 homes, and Fannie Mae would finance every one of them. After the crash, it plummeted to 2, and we weren't doing much investment property financing at all. That's why it was so difficult to move some properties after the crash. Investors couldn't buy them because they couldn't get financing for them. It jumped up to 8. It went down to 2. It jumped to 4. It went to 6. It went to 10, and we've been back and forth. But really, over the last 4 or 5 years, the limit of 10 has held pretty constant and is currently the guidelines. Another item that many potential rental home investors talk to me about is, hey, can I buy a fixer-upper and fix it up and rent it out? Kerry, what's the answer to a home being purchased that needs fixing up?
Unfortunately, the only product we can do that with is the FHA 203K.
So. And that's not available for investment property.
Right.
So
right.
We're stuck. And again, folks, this is the reason that foreclosed homes and damaged homes and homes in states that need repair are such bargains, because getting the financing for them is very, very difficult. You cannot just do a straight out regular permanent loan on a home that is not in marketable and ready to live in shape. We actually have to get you an interim type of construction loan to do that. Qualifying for that loan is even more difficult than qualifying for the permanent financing. Again, these things can be done, but our suggestion is, if you're going to get into the field of owning rental properties, buy a home that's, you know, purchased correctly and all that. You don't have to overpay for it. But you probably want to start off with just a fairly vanilla standard home whose rent covers the mortgage payment. Get that experience under your belt, and then try to open up your options for fixer-uppers and for other types of homes like that later on, after you have far more lending options at your control, because it's going to be difficult with the first one. We actually have started with many investors at their very first home, and I have had clients who have gone right up to the limit of 10, and then I've even helped them get financing beyond that limit through commercial sources once they've exhausted their total Fannie Mae number of 10. So we're happy to help you with that. But you don't need to look at acquiring rental property as, well, I'm going to go out in the next year and buy 10 properties, because that's just not going to happen. And instead, you need a very viable plan in place in which step by step you acquire the assets, the homes that will serve you immediately as rental properties, that will serve you in the future for liquidation, or will serve you in the future for retirement income once you have paid the mortgages off. And that involves a strategy that I feel has to be long term, and we will help you plot that strategy if you just come sit with us, sit down, talk to us, and we'll go over all the ins and outs of these things. I have a last question here, Kerry, that quite often investors ask.
Can I purchase a rental home using an LLC for liability protection?
When you own a rental property, just like when you own your property, if someone walks onto your property and is injured by tripping, falling, stepping a hole, your tree limb falls on their house, there are potential liabilities that arise. Now, those are insurable liabilities, but many people want the added protection of holding the home in an LLC or a partnership so that from a liability standpoint, the rest of their assets are sheltered should there be a liability claim. Now, the immediate answer to that is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do not allow for an LLC to take title to the property at the point of purchase. They will not finance a property whose owner is an LLC, even if you're the 100% owner of the LLC. So it's necessary if you're going to use residential type financing, which, by the way, gives you long-term fixed rates. Commercial financing will not do that. But the residential financing, you will have to take title to the property in your name, your personal name, when you buy the property. Now, in practice, many investors do just that. They close in their name, and then they will transfer the property through a deed to their 100% owned LLC. That is certainly a legal transaction, and that is an acceptable transaction. However, technically, because you have transferred the deed from yourself to another entity, it has the potential to trigger the due on sale clause that is in all mortgages. The due on sale clause means if you ever sell this property, you have to pay the mortgage off. And when you transfer the deed to your LLC, there is the potential that you have triggered that due on sale clause. All I can say is that in all the 30 years I've been doing this, I have never seen a lender come back and say, well, you transferred this to your LLC, so I'm sorry, you're going to have to pay the mortgage off. I cannot promise you it won't happen. And I wouldn't sit here and tell you that it couldn't happen, but I've never seen it happen. And indeed, this is the practice of many investors, strictly for liability purposes, and it does transfer the deed out of your name. So the liability now is held entirely by the LLC, and your insurance policy will cover the LLC in the event of any liability claims, and that cannot be penetrated to you personally.
And similarly, if you need to refinance a property that's currently in an LLC, it just needs to be transferred into your name before we close it, and then you could potentially transfer it back to the LLC afterward.
And again, we do this in practice all the time, although we have to say to you, please be aware that it could trigger your due on sale clause. Well, Kerry, there are a lot of other ins and outs of rental home and rental home financing. We want to move on right now to vacation homes. Or what in our industry, how do we term vacation homes?
Well, vacation homes are usually second homes.
That's what they call them. And there's a very standard definition of what is a second home or what is a vacation home that distinguishes it from a rental home. Because, first of all, we'll always get the question, well, if this is a second home, can I rent it out? Can you rent out a second home?
You can, as long as you occupy it for a certain amount of time each year.
That's right, and we're going to talk about that. But yes, you can rent your beach house, you can rent your mountain house. That does not necessarily turn it into a rental property, but it can. So we have to be careful about how that's done, and we're going to talk about how to chart your way through those waters so you don't trigger a situation where you get stuck with a higher interest rate or more strict terms. So a vacation home is defined by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The definition used to be either a home that is 100 miles away from your primary residence or is in a resort setting, to now the guideline is essentially the house that you are buying, if you are going to declare it to be a vacation home, it must be in a quote-unquote resort setting. Now, many criteria will satisfy that. What are some general criteria, Carrie, that you can pretty well be assured, hey, this is okay as a second home?
You know, if it's in a beach area or a mountainous area, there's a lake nearby, yes. Anything like that.
Anything like that. And so you don't have to have beachfront, but neither should you probably be like 5 miles off the beach. You know, if you're trying to just buy a home down in Myrtle Beach to rent out, and it's really going to be rental property, but you're going to try to call it a second home, it's got to be in enough of a setting where, under normal circumstances, people would call it a resort home. And so there's a little bit of leeway there, but you still have to meet that criteria. Now, the advantages of being able to call it a second home are tremendous. First of all, down payment. We mentioned that with investment properties, rental properties, you're going to have to minimally put 15% down, but usually you're going to be putting 20% down. What is our second home minimum down payment, Carrie?
It's 10%.
Okay, and if you put 10% down on a vacation home, again, you will have a PMI premium. And I need to make a little aside here, whereas with primary residences, you're going to have the choice between a regular monthly PMI premium or going with what we call lender-paid MI, which has no monthly PMI premium. It's a slightly higher rate, but it avoids the monthly PMI premium. You only have that option on primary residences. You do not have that option on investment properties. And unfortunately, you do not have that option on a vacation home. So again, when, you know, the rubber meets the road, most people will put 20% down on a vacation home, but they can be done with as little as 10% down. Now, if you rent your vacation home out, down the road, you may need to refinance that home, again, for a lot of reasons. There may be a better rate. There may be you need cash out to do improvements to it. So we're going to talk about how to be very careful that you keep your second home a vacation home and do not inadvertently turn it into a rental property where you might be very restricted in your options. We get back off the break. We'll talk about that, and we'll cover Airbnb. For joining us again, folks. We're talking about vacation home financing. We had also covered rental home financing. If you have any questions about anything we've covered here or just want to ask about your own scenario, pick up the phone and call me, 864-235-9596. We're open weekdays, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8.
Although no, you are sometimes there at 5.
I am sometimes there at early, but let's try 8 to 5. I usually try not to answer the phone before 8 because I get so much work done early in the morning. But call us. We'll be glad to talk through your scenario. We want to cover how to make sure that your second home stays a second home, because the penalty for not doing that can be as much as a 1 to 1.25 interest rate differential should you ever go to refinance that house. And it gets down to your tax returns. Now, CPAs, I've got to say, as a profession, I admire that profession probably as many as any I've ever encountered. The people that are in that business are, I have just found to be highly ethical, very well trained. They know what they're talking about. And I suggest, as your complexities increase on your tax returns, that you enlist the services of a CPA. The only thing that happens is that CPAs, in doing their job, are going to give you great tax advice. But unfortunately, that may at times run counter to what is helpful in the mortgage end of things. So what I like to say is, let us team up with your CPA. When you have these tax returns and you're wondering, should I file this way or that way, talk to us also, because we can save you a lot of headaches. If you are going to retain the home that you've bought in a resort area as a vacation home, the IRS stipulates that you have to retain use, personal use, of that home 15 days out of the calendar year, and then you can call it a second home. Now, many accountants will say, well, don't worry about that. You're collecting rent on it. Let's just call it a rental home because it's better for tax purposes. And that can be the case. There are upper limitations, have been upper limitations to the amount of interest you could write off as a primary and vacation home. And you don't have the same restrictions with investment property. So we've oftentimes had people come to us to refinance their beach house only to find that their CPA did not stipulate that the owner use the house for those 15 days, and our lender would not then accept it as a vacation property refinance. There is on a Schedule E, where you report rental income, also a box beside each property that you put the address on that asks the question, was this house used for personal usage 15 days out of the year? You either check yes or no. If you check no, the IRS declares it to be investment property. Again, that may give you some tax advantages, but unfortunately, it'll shoot you in the foot if you're trying to refinance it as a vacation home, because the lender's going to treat it just like you declared it to be on your last 2 years' tax returns. So always check with us on those matters as you get to tax time. Again, there may be some compelling reasons to call it investment property, and maybe you're not going to need to refinance it for the next 2 years. But always engage that discussion with your CPA and with us, because it makes a tremendous difference.
And you may think, you know, why don't I just go ahead and check that box? I did occupy it for 15 days. Well, you would have to have actually filed it that way. And the lender does request transcripts to verify tax returns. So
yeah, it's not always something you can go back and fix.
Right. Always better to just call us and talk to us about it first than thinking you can fix it on your own.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Carrie. So if you meet the criteria of purchasing or refinancing a vacation home, here's the good news. Your rate is going to be the exact same rate as a primary residence. And I think that's surprising, really, because, again, given the choice, do I make my vacation home payment or my regular home payment, you're going to choose your primary residence first. So a second home is a higher risk category, but fortunately the default rate on those is about the same as primary residences. So as long as you can declare it to be a vacation home, you're going to get the same rate on your second home that you're going to get on your primary residence. The other good news, PMI is available. So you can finance up to 90% of your purchase price when you purchase a vacation home. And other good news, jumbo products, that is when your loan amount is going to exceed $453,100, there is jumbo financing available for second homes. I will say this, though, jumbo financing is limited to 80%. Once you go over that $453,100, you can no longer do 90% financing for a vacation home. However, financing is readily available. Only bad news in all of this is the lender-paid MI, where you pay a slightly higher interest rate but avoid a monthly PMI premium. Unfortunately, that's not available right now on second homes. I have a feeling it will be, though. I think they will probably bring that over the next year or two. It would make sense that they would. Carrie, let's talk a minute about property types that can be financed as vacation homes. Obviously, we can do single-family residence. What about townhouses, condos, those kind of things?
Well, and we always like to throw in condos when we can because they are more complicated. Townhouses are fine, no issues there. Condos, we do have the same extra requirements that we have to meet. Especially, you might have issues if you're, you know, in a resort area where they have on-site rentals. That throws a kink in things. They can't be condotels. You can't have random people renting out your property. So there's extra things that we have to go through to qualify a condo. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, the condo remains across all the spectrum of lending the most difficult property type to finance. And when it comes to a second home, the problem is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac require a certain owner-occupied percentage in a condo complex before they'll finance it, and that's often not met in resort areas. Carrie mentioned something called a condotel, and you're probably not familiar with that term. A condotel is a condominium, and you own it as a horizontal regime just like you would any other condo. However, it has an on-site rental office. So it operates a little bit like a hotel, a little bit like a condo, and that's where the name condotel comes from. Let me state clearly that Condotel financing is not available through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac channels. It is available through some portfolio products. You will expect to pay a much higher rate with much more down payment. Condotels are notoriously difficult to finance. You can talk to us about them, but we'd probably recommend you avoid them if possible. And finally, as far as the condo itself and determining whether a unit is a condo, remember, it is whether the property is in a horizontal property regime that makes the difference in that. We've talked about the underwriting qualifications for investment properties, which are a bit more stringent. And for second home, they are also slightly more stringent, but not as bad as owning an investment property. So let's talk a minute about what you'll face when you go to qualify for a second home. Carrie, first of all, what is the minimum score threshold that we see for a second home?
It is a 680.
And again, all of these scenarios have to be run through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac's automated underwriting system for acceptance. Typically, we do not see any acceptance below a 680 score if you're buying a second home. Carrie, how do they treat the payment on a second home? And will they let you count any potential rent of your vacation home to qualify?
Well, you couldn't count any rent for your vacation home. You do have to be able to qualify carrying your current residence payment and all of your debts and the new mortgage payment.
That's right. So you're not going to be able to use any potential rent income off a vacation home in order to qualify. You basically, your house ratio, debt ratio that you have to meet remains your current primary residence, but then your second home payment gets added to your other debts, and you have to meet the debt-to-income ratio requirements, the standard requirements, carrying both mortgage payments. Carrie, what about reserves? Second homes require reserves?
You actually don't need them for a second home.
And unless the automated underwriting system stipulates that to strengthen the loan, you need reserves. Generally speaking, you're not going to need reserves when you go into a second home loan, as you would need reserves, 6 months reserves, if you were buying an investment property. So again, slightly lower risk threshold, slightly lower requirements. We mentioned that the conforming loan limit for a vacation home is $453,000. Remember, that's the loan amount, not the purchase price. You could buy a $900,000 house and put $450 down and still finance it with a conforming loan. But that is the loan limit. Above that, you're going to be in a jumbo category. No problem with that, although you'll have to put 20% down on the jumbo, where you've got the option of 10% down with a conforming. Again, if you're looking at refinancing a second home, your net rental income that you've reported as a landlord on your second home can be counted if you're refinancing a second home. It cannot be counted if you're buying the home. But if you have the 2 years experience, and remember, even though you're declaring income, you have to check that box that says that you've retained personal use of the property for 15 days out of the year. If the box is checked, you're allowed to use the average net rent income off your vacation home to help you qualify on a refinance loan. You just simply cannot use that on a purchase loan. So all in all, your risk category and your criteria for purchasing a second home, a little more stringent than a primary, but certainly not prohibitive. Not as much as an investment or rental property, but still you have to be a slightly above an average to be able to qualify for vacation home financing. Home stretch, looking at rental home, vacation home financing, and we're going to talk about Airbnb, a topic surely of interest to many people now that that has become or is becoming a part of mainstream home ownership. I'm not sure what Airbnb stands for. The B&B sounds like bed and breakfast, but do you know, Carrie, where that came from?
No, I don't.
I don't either. I'm not sure where it came from, but Airbnb is an internet-driven site in which you can rent the room out in your primary residence. You can rent your vacation home or part of your vacation home. We have people that rent the upstairs to people and keep the downstairs. I mean, it's really an incredibly flexible rental platform mm-hmm. that a lot of people are beginning to use. We have a lot of clients outside our listing area, but they come out of Charleston, and boy, that's a really popular place for Airbnb yeah. because I think hotels down there are pretty expensive. So a lot of people visiting Charleston just for vacation will look to Airbnb. And, you know, our family has done Airbnb rentals when we went skiing or went to the mountains. So it's becoming a very popular platform. But, you know, as so many things that are new, it is blurring all of the distinctions between a primary residence, a second home, a rental property. It's kind of like, okay, I used Airbnb to rent one of my bedrooms in my primary residence. So is it still a primary residence? And that's a legitimate question, because in the past, there was a clear distinction. Either it was your primary residence, it was not for rental purposes, or, hey, it was a rental property, and you rent it. But now, this has totally changed the perspective. So quite frankly, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have not yet clearly determined how they're going to treat Airbnb. Now, so far, nobody has lost the classification of a primary residence because they used Airbnb, and that's the good news, and that is not going to happen. You could go ahead and rent your primary residence or part of the time under Airbnb, and I don't think you stand in any danger of Fannie and Freddie coming back and saying, hey, this is no longer your primary residence because you got rent on it. On the other hand, it blurs the distinction with second homes and even with rental properties. But let's talk about right now. Fannie Mae has just not given us any ruling on it. Right now, though, that means you can't count your Airbnb income if you're refinancing or buying another home, even if you've reported it on your tax return. Freddie Mac actually has a pilot program that they are running right now, and my understanding is that will run for another year. They'll track the default statistics on people who start using their primary residences for Airbnb rental. They'll be checking to make sure, well, do people still really live there, or are they just calling it their primary residence and trying to get some rent income? We won't know the results on that for a while. So where we stand right now is we're a little bit in limbo. One of the things that we found is very confusing about this is how the Airbnb income is actually reported. Where have you seen that reported, Carrie, on people's tax returns? Where is it showing up?
Well, we've seen it on both Schedule C for self-employed and Schedule E for rental properties.
For rental properties, yeah. And again, what are you doing when you rent out a room in your house? Are you running a business out of your home because now you're self-employed because you reported on a Schedule C? Or are you a landlord now that you've rented a room out on Airbnb? And again, you can understand the lenders just simply have not been able yet to define. And the reason they haven't defined it yet is they just simply don't have the statistical information to know if any of this affects the performance of the loan. Whether, again, a borrower may be less likely to go into default if they're able to use Airbnb income, or more likely because it becomes more like a rental property to them and they'll walk away from it.
And, you know, it just popped into my head we talked about not being able to have short-term rentals. Well, with Airbnb, you know, we just came back from vacation, yeah, and it's in a vacation area, and this person had new people coming in and out all the time.
I know.
In fact, it's interesting to think about how they're going to.
It is. And, you know, in regard to vacation properties, a lot of times, you know, you turn that over to a property manager in the area, and you do. It's rented week to week, but this Airbnb platform kind of lets you do it all yourself. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just a tremendous tool, like the internet is in so many things, but it also kind of upends the status quo so that for a while, we really don't have a lot of clear parameters on how to do this. I will mention this. Of all the issues we have seen, and again, I mentioned earlier, CPAs are just tremendous people to have on your team. Highly ethical, great, great profession. Again, they are going to do things from a tax perspective. So we've seen many CPAs take Airbnb income and report it under a Schedule C. Now, from a loan standpoint, in my opinion, this generates a number of potential issues, mm-hmm, in which I am going to say, not as a CPA for tax reasons, but as a mortgage person for borrowing reasons, that is not where you want to report your Airbnb income. Number one, a Schedule C immediately puts that income and that part of your life into a self-employment status. Not only for tax purposes, but in a worse way for lending purposes. Much more difficult to get qualified as a self-employed borrower as it is for if you are a statutory employee. So the Schedule C, I don't believe, is a good place for that reason. Also, there's a sense in which if you are running a business out of your home, there are some lending regulations that Fannie and Freddie have in place that you may go afoul of. Everyone's allowed to have a home office, and that doesn't violate your primary resident status with Fannie or Freddie, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're running a quote-unquote commercial business out of your home. But again, Airbnb begins to blur that distinction. And if at any time Fannie and Freddie decide that reporting Airbnb income on a Schedule C not only makes you self-employed, but it means that you're running a commercial business out of your residential home, then they will rule that they won't finance that property. And we don't know that yet, but I would just say err to the side of caution. And what we would recommend is that you report your Airbnb income on a Schedule E. That way you have established it strictly as rental income and not as business income. There's a third thing that you would have to watch out for, and again, your CPA can give you guidance on this, but if at any time in the regular course of the type of business you do, if you are in real estate and you are a professional real estate agent, you are not always able to report gains as capital gains, which have half the tax rate of regular income, because you are a professional. So let me put it this way. A professional realtor buys a rental property. Because they are a professional realtor, that rental property may not be seen by the IRS as rental property that you bought today and sell tomorrow, and the gain on that sale is only subject to capital gains tax. They can look at that as regular income because you are an industry professional. If you file your Airbnb income on a Schedule C, you are declaring yourself to be in an industry, and I think it runs the risk down the road of your not being able to defer or to avoid regular income taxation when you could have gotten capital gains exemptions. And again, just for all those reasons, our suggestion would be file your Airbnb income under a Schedule E, unless your CPA, you know, says something like, well, you're going to go to jail if you do that. And we'll come bail you out if they do.
And again, these are just, you know, our opinions because we don't know definitively what's going to be decided. So just based on the trends of what we've seen in the past, this is the best plan of attack that we can come up with.
That's correct. Now, we're seeing some real stinks raised in some cities, particularly San Francisco. Of course, it's a lot of stirring out there all over the time about a lot of things. But there are subdivision covenants that when you bought your house, you agreed to abide by. And many subdivision covenants do not allow for the running of a business out of your home, a commercial business out of your home. If you file a Schedule C with your Airbnb income, that can be a lever if your homeowners association sues you and says, we're tired of seeing all these strange cars coming in and out of the neighborhood into your driveway all the time because you're clogging up the roads because there's too many people renting your rooms in your house. And this has actually happened in San Francisco. There have been lawsuits in which the neighborhood association sue the homeowner saying you cannot rent your house using Airbnb because that's a business. If you file it on a Schedule E, it's going to be harder for them to declare that to be a business. Now, they can say, well, you can't rent it out, but your case is going to be much stronger. So as some of these things are sorting their way through the legal systems, through the lending systems, we want to kind of just give you this advice, maybe just to be a little cautious in the manner in which you report these, just so if any of the final decisions go against you, you will be in as safe a place as possible with Airbnb income. So report it on your Schedule E unless your CPA just really insists on not doing it. Don't use a Schedule C. We don't want to establish you as self-employed and make your loan qualifying more difficult. We don't want to brand you as a professional in the real estate field because That can affect how you have to report your income down the road. You may end up subjecting yourselves to normal taxation, normal income taxation, rather than capital gains taxation. For all these reasons, we would suggest the Schedule E. Now, as far as your vacation home goes, if you are using Airbnb for obtaining clients to rent your home week to week, we don't suggest you make any changes to your tax reporting. It is rental income, and even if you didn't use Airbnb, the rental income would be the same. It would be a weekly type of rent, week to week. Just remember, because it's a vacation home, do not rent it out for 365 days of the year. And that means don't ever sign a 12-month lease with anybody. If someone comes along and you've got a vacation home that you're not going to use over the next year, and somebody says, well, I want to rent it for a whole year, well, make that like an 11-month rent, 11-month lease, not a 12-month, because you'll default away from your vacation home classification. You'll end up having to declare it as investment property. And again, if you ever need to refinance that thing, you're going to get stuck with a higher interest rate. Last caution, just as Airbnb is floating around, I think you should consult with your insurance agent, because here's what can happen with Airbnb. Airbnb for your primary residence may violate your homeowner's insurance clauses. Now, so far, I haven't heard of this happening, but on the other hand, it's always the fine print that gets us. Just check in with your real estate and with your insurance agent. If you're going to rent your primary residence out or even rent rooms out, make sure you're covered. Make sure your liability umbrella will cover any instances. Just protect yourself in these. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you'll join us again next Saturday.